Chapter 9. Do not touch the filled vase. The translation of Chapter 9 of the Tao Te Ching seems to have given sinologists a great deal of trouble. This can be attributed to their lack of any key to the true meaning of Lao Tzu's words. One translation reads, "It is better to carry no vase at all than to carry a filled vase on both sides." An absurd rendering if one accepts that the Chinese text is referring to a water vessel. The ancients did not have water mains, so filled water jugs must have been essential to them. Therefore, they would surely have been only too eager to carry them, trying not to spill a single drop of the much-needed fluid. Another translator saw the significance of this point about spilling the water and put forward the following translation. "He who fills a vase to the brim and tries to carry it along with both hands will spill it." Having seen what the previous chapters of the Tao contained, we realize that Lao Tzu must have meant something quite different. The difficulty for translators is that, in fact, the Tao Te Ching cannot be translated. The alphabet we use today is fixed and enables us to look at a combination of letters and know exactly what the word is and what it means. But the ancient Chinese pictograms in which the Tao Te Ching was written down are not like that. Take the word tree, for instance. A modern author can write, "I see a tree," and although we may not know what kind of tree, we know it is a tree he can see. But the ancient Chinese pictograms, even more so than Hebrew, for instance, carried a variety of meanings, at least seven in fact. And a Chinese person of any standing had the freedom to add his own nuances to a character after he had painted its basic shape on parchment or silk. So without a formula, without a method, ancient Chinese characters are virtually a secret code. In practice, owing to the needs of commerce and social intercourse, people adopted the habit of using the same characters to represent particular concepts, simply so that if a person wasn't there to speak to, it would be possible to communicate by letter. Even so, the sender and receiver always needed to know in advance the meaning of the characters being used. That is why, although many words in ancient Chinese can be read, many more cannot, as a result of which the context is lost. And in any case, the language of the ancient Chinese Bible was not intended for sinologists who might possibly wish to translate it at some later date. Their translations differ hopelessly, and no wonder. The Tao Te Ching was intended solely for pupils on the transfiguristic path, and the author knew for certain, even though he wrote thousands of years ago, that a servant of the Brotherhood, even though only a beginner, would be able to read the Tao Te Ching quite easily, untold years later. How is that possible, you may ask? You don't know any Chinese, and even if you did, surely you would be faced with the same difficulties as the sinologists. The answer is really quite simple. Throughout all ages, the Universal Brotherhood has designed its words, whether spoken or written, to appeal to the imaginative consciousness of those who are inwardly ready to understand them. In every line of such language lies a key which, if the reader is able to identify and understand it, easily unlocks the rest of the meaning. If the reader is not able to identify the key, he will understand nothing and will not be able to translate the true meaning, even if he is the most educated person of all time. Here, too, the biblical words apply, that what remains hidden from the wise and learned of ordinary nature is revealed to the children of God, Matthew 11:25. We do not think it is pride that makes us say we are children of God. You are, too. You also possess that childship. Some people are rather more conscious of this than others, but we are all equal, and perfection is waiting for every one of us. So now let us try together to find the key to Chapter 9, guided by our awareness of being children of God. The first thing we notice is that Chapter 9 opens with a reference to some kind of filled vase or vessel. All translators are in agreement on that point. They also agree that there is something one must definitely not do with that vase. Now, what does a vase contain? Water, of course. So one translator concludes that what one must not do is spill any of the water. That's true, says another, but such a vase is heavy, so it would be better not to carry it. Of course one must not spill the water, that is clear, but in my opinion, Lao Tzu meant that it is not possible to hold on to the vase and fill it at the same time. Well, we can do that nowadays, of course, because all we need to do is turn on the tap, but the ancients did not have any water mains. Yes, but they did have waterfalls. And so the discussion continues. But where does it lead? Nowhere, because everyone has overlooked the key. But the part of your mind that thinks in pictures will have absorbed the key long ago, for the image of the filled vessel or vase is very familiar to you. We see before us a 17th century Rosicrucian symbol. A sage, old and grey, sits in a chamber in a tower. Three steps lead into it, bearing the words, "The Steps to Wisdom." When we climb these three steps leading into the tower room, we notice that the entrance is flanked by two pillars, and our attention is drawn by the aphorism inscribed on the right-hand pillar. It says, "Stay close to the vase to make its colours known." In Isaiah chapter 52, we read these words, "Depart, depart, go out thence, touch no unclean thing, go out from the midst of her, purify yourselves, you who bear the vessels of the Lord." In Acts chapter 10, we read of a very unholy vessel descending from the heavens. In his second letter to Timothy, Paul says, "If anyone purifies himself from what is ignoble, then he will be a vessel for noble use, consecrated and useful to the Lord." 2 Timothy 2:21. We also remember the many symbolic stories about the Grail Cup, open like the calyx of a lily. And we hear Lao Tzu say, "Do not touch the filled vase." And now we know that is the key. The child of God possesses a filled vase, the seven-petaled rose, the seven-petaled calyx of the lily, the Grail Cup of the heart. The child of God is a child of God precisely because he possesses that holy cup. It constitutes the entire kingdom of God in us. A whole universe is contained within the primordial atom. In that atom lies the all. However, the dialectical self presents an extreme danger as far as these things are concerned. Your ego is not the child of God. Your dialectical consciousness has nothing to do with it. Your ego is a robot consciousness, quite incapable of liberation. You occupy a microcosm in which the divine being lies enclosed, and the Tao Te Ching says to you, "Please keep your fingers off that filled vase." The Grail Cup is filled with the blood of the Lamb, with the pure living water, and not one drop of the unholy nature may be added to it. So do not go near it. Keep your distance in absolute self-surrender. Please refrain from saying "I," with the emphasis on the "I," "am a child of God." You are only very close to the child of God. It is in the same microcosm as you. The other one was there long before you and will be there long after. You must diminish, and the other one must increase. Do not touch the filled vase of the Lord. You, with your mystical or occult delusion, must not lay hands on the holy vessel. This Grail Cup contains the wine of the Lord, and this wine, this living water, must touch you. It must quench your thirst. This power must descend into your soul like a sword. Continuing with the same metaphor, Lao Tzu says, "Do not touch the sharp edge of the blade, do not render it powerless with unholy hands, and do not say, 'The sword will descend into me in such and such a way, under my guidance.'" Empty the cup extended to you by the inner Christ. Accept it, full of joy. Have you never read or heard that the masters of the Grail placed the Grail cup in a beautiful temple, in a sanctuary filled with gold and jewels, and that this sanctuary of the wondrous rose was filled with the most precious, glorious riches imaginable. Well, there is such a sanctuary in your microcosm. Rejoice and be glad. The kingdom of God is within you. It is the New Jerusalem with its 12 gates. But you need to realize the danger inherent in the ego's insane lust for possession. Do you want to keep that hall filled with gold and jewels for yourself? You? Do you want to give free rein to your pride of possession as a mystic or a cultist? If you do, you will experience all the misfortune of that continued turning of the wheel. For the new city with its pearly gates can only descend when the old city has disappeared. See the way of heaven before you. When the time has come and your preparatory work has been completed, and your new name conceived for the book of life, you, with your whole dialectical soul state, will need to withdraw, as expressed in those tremendous words of John, which contain the key to the path of liberation. He, the other one, must increase, and I must diminish. You will need to withdraw with the sword of the Master of the Grail in your soul, having emptied his cup to the last drop, so that the holy city may come down out of heaven from God. Now let us return to the treasure chamber of the classical Rosicrucians, where we can see the pillar on which are the words, "Stay close to the vase to make its colors known." When the Rosicrucians said, "Stay close to the vase," they meant, devote yourself as an eye being, humbly and quietly, in forbearance and self-sacrifice, to the inner grail, to the city of God that will one day descend out of heaven. This is the only right attitude to have with respect to the vase, and if we adopt it, then there is the possibility that, in the service of the vase, we may be permitted to make the holy words known to those who have gone astray and are seeking. We may be allowed to make the beautiful, serene colors and aspects of the vase known, so that seekers, comforted by this glorious promise, will one day be able to follow the same path. The words quoted from Isaiah chapter 52 are a call to all spirit spark bearers to say farewell to the world of dialectics by undergoing the Endurer. Go out from the midst of her, purify yourselves, you who bear the vessels of the Lord. That is why Paul says that when you follow the path of self-emptying, a new soul state becomes possible through the Grail Cup, consecrated and useful to the Lord. And in Acts chapter 10, Peter undergoes a very archetypal test. The forces of the reflection sphere offer him the false cup, but when he sees its contents, he realizes the danger straight away and rejects it firmly. His resolve is more steadfast than ever. He stays close to the vase of the heart to make its colors known. That is the signature of the Rosicrucian, the servant of the universal brotherhood. He stays close to the vase of the heart to make its colors known. He himself will never take the credit for this. Though he has become immeasurably rich, he will never indulge in pride on account of it, because he who is proud of his wealth will suffer misfortune. Pride is showing off. Pride is love of ostentation. Pride makes concessions to I-centrality. It spoils the radiance of the vase, making it dull and colorless once more. When, through the practical application of the fivefold universal gnosis, true riches are gained, then the great work must be fulfilled. Then admittance is granted to the immeasurable treasure chambers of the universal life. Then one speaks in the plural. Then the words are spoken, "You who bear the vessels of the Lord." Then we discover that the living body, which is formed by its many members, receives the same treasures in its power field by means of its liberating magic. What is within us becomes at the same time what is outside us. Boundaries fall away and we experience the unity of the universal in the universal. In this way, the light is carried out into the night to awaken those who are of the night. In this way, in the night, the light is born. In this way, those who are chosen keep together to make the colors of the light known in all their immeasurable diversity. But those who do not want to let go of the night are perturbed, for they do not want to see the colors of the vase, and hence they tumble into confusion. From confusion, doubt arises, and they say, "Yesterday you said it was green, and today you say it is blue." They do not understand that though the ocean, like the aquamarine, has many colors, it still remains the ocean. They shun the light and do not yet have eyes to see. Nevertheless, the apostolic work continues, for the colors of the vase must be made known. The apostolic work is universal. It goes on in the sewers of the night as well as in the bright light of day. It has its origin in the broad field of the apostolic brotherhood and begins in the 32 who dare to make the attempt to put the work into practice. The night dwellers and those who shun the light ask mockingly, "Where are you now with your apostolic light?" We say, "Just observe coming events, for just as the lightning rends the darkness and makes people quake and tremble, so the divine astralis in the prepared serpent fire canal will make itself known to the whole body as a heavenly fire. The work will be fulfilled and the new name made. And when the labor is done, those who performed it will withdraw, leaving the night to the night."